Thank you, Guy, Sarada. It's such a privilege to be able to talk to you
today.
Let's get straight into it. So you, I believe, started your career as a teacher, and then you worked for some time in public policy on Capitol Hill. And then, as you've put it, you woke up one day and decided to be a speechwriter. Why?
First of all, thanks for coming out here. It's very fun to talk to you. I think probably a lot of us have had maybe non-linear paths to speech writing. So mine is not any odder than maybe some of yours. But for those of you who are in my workshop, forgive hearing this story again. But as Jess said, I started out as a teacher, and then I got very interested in public education, which you may know in America is a complete disaster. And so I was interested in education and sort of urban poverty. And I got a job working for state legislators who were working on progressive policy. And then I got my master's in public policy. And then I got a job working in policy on Capitol Hill. You're seeing a pattern. I worked for a senator. And almost maybe on my first week there, I sort of had this job that if you work in public policy is a very coveted job. And very quickly I realized that this was not the job I wanted for a few reasons. One, this sort of day-to-day of the work was not energizing to me. You know, it's a lot of haggling over small little loopholes in the law so that you can shove your boss's priority through it. A lot of negotiating with people who are more powerful than you and like to flaunt it. And it was, it could be really frustrating at times. And, but you know, I loved my office. I loved the people I was working with. Anyway, I continued in this job, and sometime in maybe early 2008, I was at a party in Washington complaining about my job, as one does at a party in Washington. And a friend of mine, somebody I'd gone to graduate school, said, "I know a guy who's a speechwriter. You should really talk to him." And probably like many of you, I did not think that was a real job, speechwriting. And I said, "Is that a job?" And she said, "No, it's really a job. And he has this job and you should talk to him." And it turned out this person was a partner at a firm called West Wing Writers. And so I talked to him, and it was just a fun conversation. And I think I quickly realized why my friend thought I might be attracted to this, that it combined writing, which I'd always loved, but didn't quite know how to get a job in, with policy and politics and history. And so I chatted with him, and I ended up interviewing with the partners at this firm. And this was in 2008, and the financial crisis happened. And so as fun as it was to chat with them, they weren't hiring. And then a guy named Barack Obama was running for president. Then he won. And suddenly we were doing healthcare reform, affectionately known now as Obamacare. And so because I was a healthcare policy staffer for the senator I worked for, I was now just knee deep in healthcare. And that year of working on healthcare in the Senate was brutal, as you might imagine. But what it also did was solidify my interest in moving over into communications, because as important and transformational as this law was going to be once it passed and has been, although it must sound ridiculous to all of you who live in a civilized countries with real healthcare, we expanded health insurance to a few more people and we think we're great. It was so unpopular for a bunch of reasons, but one of them was that we just could not explain it. We did a terrible job of explaining why this policy was going to be incredibly helpful to many people and why they should support it. And if you're a policy person and you've spent all this time working on it and everybody hates this law, it's maddening. And so I just realized that I was more interested in being on that side of things. And so I ended up, after we finally passed the law and President Obama signed it in 2010, I was exhausted. I wanted to leave the Hill. West Wing Writers was not hiring. So I ended up taking a job at an education nonprofit that I had worked with a lot. They knew I wanted to be doing more communications work. So they sort of made up a job for me. And on my third day at this new job, one of the partners from West Wing Writers calls me and says, "Hey, you want to come work here?" And I said, "You couldn't have freaking called me last week." But I ended up leaving that job and I went to West Wing Writers. And 4.5 years later, the White House called. So entirely luck, really. As I think you know, I mean, these jobs are 75% luck, right? So right place, right time.
And a bit of brilliance too, Sarada. You obviously learned a lot on the way. And it's 2014 by this point, and you are senior speechwriter and special assistant to President Barack Obama.
Right.
So back 10 years ago now.
I can't believe it, yeah.
Yeah. How did you feel when you first heard him delivering words that you had written?
I don't know if I thought about it that way. Terror was probably the real feeling that I'm sure we've all felt when our principal starts speaking and you're very worried that everything you've written is incorrect, the teleprompter is going to break. Or in my case, I mean, every day you walk into the White House, you walk through those gates, and you feel like a complete fraud. What am I doing here? I would just imagine that at some point during the day, large men with large guns were going to come into my office and say, "Ma'am, there's been a terrible mistake." And that was every day.
And you talk about walking in through the gates into your office, which I believe is known as the speech cave.
Oh.
What was your writing environment like?
Okay, so the White House, if you haven't seen it, it's a very odd place and it's very small. I would have relatives from India come visit and I would give them a tour and they would be so underwhelmed. it's not very big, it's not very nice. And in the West Wing, there's sort of a major rodent problem. It's really unimpressive. So the White House itself in the West Wing is quite small. So there isn't that much room for staff. So when most people say they work in the White House, they actually work in the very large building next door to it called the Old Executive Office Building, renamed the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, because in Washington, we like to rename everything after Republican presidents. And it's very large. And so my office was there. I was in a suite of speechwriters. It included the domestic speechwriters on our team, plus Mrs. Obama's two speechwriters, which included Sarah Hurwitz, who I know some of you know. And then Cody, our chief speechwriter, and his deputy, Terry Zuplat, who I know many of you also know, they were in the West Wing, in the speech cave, in the basement. And what's really odd is that Terry's office was inside of Cody's office. So saying the other day, it was like Lesotho inside of South Africa. It was sort of this weird, like, so you had to go through Cody's office to get to Terry. Anyway, their office was the cave. And then our assistant speechwriter sat sort of outside of their little arrangement. So every day, we were always walking back and forth to the West Wing and to Cody's office. So it was, and it was just a short walk. But my office was grand. So really funny. So the building used to be the Department of State and War. And so it's a beautiful ornate building. And my office was enormous for no reason at all. I had this giant corner office. And so everybody would come and hang out in my office and destroy my office. But the environment was such that we were all together and you could walk into each other's offices if you were stuck, if you needed help, which, as you know, speechwriters were often very isolated. So it was actually really lovely to be in a space with my colleagues. I feel like that was a gift that I probably won't get again. It was really nice.
You know, Downing Street has a rodent problem as well.
Yeah.
I saw mice.
It's so odd.
Horrible. Why? Yeah, really horrible.
And a solvable problem, right?
Like, yeah, well, they got a cat in number 10. So yeah, maybe something idea to suggest. So what about the process of writing a speech for President Obama, kind of from the beginning till him actually delivering it? What process would you go through?
This is only interesting to this audience, so
I'm happy
to share it. And then I want Jess to share how the process from Tim Downing. But so curious if this sounds familiar to folks here and if it's similar, but Cody was also a member of the senior staff, which all these very specific designations when you work in government, right? So the senior staff, they would meet with the president every single morning. And so he would have a general sense of what was coming down the pike, big speeches we could expect, but also just generally the schedule. And then we would meet as a team a few times a week. And he would assign speeches. We were divided into domestic policy speechwriters and then two people who wrote foreign policy speeches, including Terry. And so Cody would get the schedule and he would assign them. And it really depended on just who had time, frankly, who had interest. You know, maybe somebody had a particular area of expertise or interest. I was the only woman, so I got the girl speeches, you know, that kind of thing. I say that only half facetiously. And then we would usually maybe talk to, especially when I first got there and I was again, terrified. I would probably talk to Cody about a general outline, what he thought the flow should be. And then you go, and let's just say it's an education speech or a trade policy speech. I would go and read whatever previous speeches the president had delivered on that subject. By 2014, there had been many. And then I would talk to the policy staff that were sort of organizing the speech, who were behind whatever initiative we would be talking about. And I think, I suspect this is true for many people, but so often a policy wouldn't actually crystallize until someone says, oh, the president should give a speech about this. Right. And then everybody goes into gear and now we have to crystallize what we are actually doing and how we're going to talk about it. And so in a way, our page becomes the place where all of this is litigated and people are kind of arguing about what we should put in the speech. And you're the person who is managing all of that. I suspect that's true for a lot of us. So I would write I would usually talk to everybody, write a draft. Cody would send it to Cody or Terry. They would edit it. It would come back to us. Then this is going to sound very upsetting, but the day before the speech, because the president was busy, say around 10 a.m., I would send the speech to a listserv of something like 100 people, okay? Not all of these people would read the speech. So there are people who had nothing to do with your particular speech and would not bother reading it. National Security Advisor Susan Rice, however, would read every speech and would email you about your typos. Yeah. Anyway, she would catch everything. So, and this list was everybody from the Chief of Staff and the National Security Advisor to our fact checkers, because we had fact checkers in our White House, and the lawyer and the lawyers. And you would say something like, here are a draft of the president's remarks for tomorrow. Say this was 10 a.m. Please send me your edits by 3 p.m. At 5 p.m., the edits would start rolling in. And as you know, people's edits can be challenging. And when I first got there, it would be like the national, people from, let's just say, pick any directorate, the National Economic Council. Multiple people from within the National Economic Council would send me incomprehensible edits that conflicted with each other. And so I very quickly learned, as you all know, process is everything, that I would have to say, you all need to collate your edits internally before you send them, make sure you agree. And if you don't, I am not taking your edits. I was kind of a hard ass. So then they start sending you their edits and you have to figure out which ones you're going to take, which is its own process, right? What is the sort of bar by which you're, you know, what is the rubric you're using to accept edits? So we would manage all those edits, you know, fix the draft, and then around 7 or 8 p.m., we would send that version to the president's book. So President Obama was a night owl, and he would do all of his homework at night. And so that in that book of homework would be, you know, his briefings for the next day, memos, policies, et cetera, and then his speeches. And then the next morning, typically, his secretary would call and say, his edits are ready, come pick them up. And he would just make handwritten edits on your drafts. Now, if it was a bigger speech and we needed more time with him, we might speak to him ahead of time. And he was a busy guy, so Cody would often make a meeting where a bunch of us were in it and we would talk about multiple speeches. So the president would go down the line, okay, this speech about, you know, we're doing the Congressional Black Caucus, here's what I wanna say. Okay, you're doing trade policy, here's what I wanna say. He would just go down the line. So sometimes we would talk to him ahead of time, it just depended. Now, if it was a bigger speech and he had more significant edits, you might get called up to the Oval Office, which never stops being terrifying. And he would just sit down and go through his edits with you. So what's really odd is that I've spent more time sitting in silence with Barack Obama than probably the average person, because he would just sort of be making his line edits. If you presented him with something and he got to a page where it was really not the direction he wanted to go in, he would just put a big X through it and take out his yellow legal pad and just start handwriting what in longhand what he wanted, which was actually, I don't know, I liked that. I liked seeing him engage with remarks. You want that, right? You don't want him to just take what you do and read it verbatim. Where's the fun in that? Where's the engagement? So then the next day when it was time for the speech and it was final, you made your edits, you would then send it again back to that same crazy list of 100 people, plus whoever was running the teleprompter. And for the US, I assume this is true here, but it's Secure Communications. So it's actually a military operation that runs it. And then the person, his body people, the people who had actually printed out hard copy just in case the prompter broke. And you would say, this is final. And then if something happened last minute, as sometimes it does, you have to run to the teleprompter and fix it right in there. But that's typically how it would work. And if he wasn't using a teleprompter, we would just print it in bigger font.
And would you go and listen to him delivering the speeches?
It depended. So if it was, yeah, sometimes we would, if it was out of town, we might travel with him to go listen. If it was in town, probably. If not, you could watch it on TV usually.
Did you find that those speeches where he gave you a steer, in a very quick steer, face to face, those would be the ones where your draft would be better or kind of hit the spot right away? Or was it just totally random whether he would get out his yellow legal pad and start rewriting?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what those conversations helped us do was, at least, I was saying the other day, a speech about anything is a speech about everything, and a speech about everything is a speech about nothing. And so having him kind of at least give you that initial steer narrowed the universe of possibility. So he might still line edit the hell out of whatever you did, but at least we had determined a general direction and he had thought about what his argument was going to be. You didn't always get that, but it definitely helped.
So interesting to hear the process. Kind of similar in Downing Street,
but
we had to print it off ourselves. I mean, yeah. I remember there was like a special thicker paper that you'd print the speech onto in very big font, got bigger and bigger each year as the Prime Minister's eye cycle got worse and worse. I think it's very large now. And then we had a red box to put the stuff into rather than a book. And Cameron is an early bird, not a night owl. Mm-hmm. So I would often be woken up by these edits that were coming through from his private office and the what called duty clerks in Downing Street. But yeah, kind of similar.
Yeah.
That's such a wonderful description of how a speech kind of starts and then is delivered. I'm interested to know, you talk about all these edits and people chipping in, and you've described your job as being one to protect the president's voice. So how would you do that with all these conflicting opinions? I mean, obviously you've said you narrow it down a bit and tell people to collate, but would you ultimately just say no, like I'm holding the pen?
Yes, depending on the edits. But not initially and not all the time. I mean, when I first got there, I was nervous about saying no to people who were just a lot smarter than I am and know a lot about, you know, this very deeply detailed economic policy. And so there is a hesitation to sort of push back on especially policy edits, especially having been a policy person. I had a lot of empathy for the folks who had worked very hard on, you know, these complicated policy issues and wanted us to explain it. So I will just a quick story on this, which those of you in my workshop forgive that you're hearing it again. But once I was working on a foreign policy speech, which did not happen all that often, and I was unfamiliar with the process and I did not know the National Security Council folks as well. And so when I sent this speech out for edits, the edits I got back were particularly terrifying. Things like, you must include mention of this particular element of this negotiation. If you don't, you might ruin the deal we have, you know. Or this country will stop talking to us if you don't include, and so I didn't know that, and I was terrified. So I included all these gobbledygook, crazy edits that were not in human English. And then I sent the draft back to Terry to look at it before I sent it to the president. And he calls me and he says, Sarita, what happened to our speech? And I said, I don't know, I panicked and I included all the edits. And he's the one who said, there are seven of us in this building whose job it is to protect the president's voice. Everybody is, you know, we all serve at his pleasure. We all are on the same team, but kind of not. and what the other folks are doing is valuable, but that's not our job. We are, and the president doesn't have time to go through this speech and make it sound like him. That's our job. So you do need to hold the line. And that was really helpful. It helped me be slightly less terrified. But what I also did was, I came in and there was some amount of animosity, I would say, between the speechwriters and the research office in particular, the lawyers. The lawyers hated us. and I think the way that editing often happened was, frankly, over email. And as we all know, email is where tone goes to die. So when I got there, I just decided that I was not going to do that. I was going to try to have good relationships with everybody. So when I got edits, especially from the lawyers, whose edits you do have to take seriously because nobody wants to end up in jail, I would just pick up the phone and say, hey, what is the thinking behind this edit? What is your interest? What are you trying to achieve here? And then we can work together to find the words that will meet that goal, as opposed to just outright rejecting whatever the word, because I'm reacting to the bad English, right? And so that's generally how I would handle tricky edits. The other thing that we had, going back to our fact checkers, is that we had a pretty intense fact-checking process. In addition to the lawyers, we had people who went through every single line to make sure checking the veracity of the source, is this number correct, etc. Complicated by the fact that our deputy research director of fact-checking is now married to Cody. So you can imagine the fights that we were all in the middle of. But you wanted to respect what they were doing because they're not wrong. We don't want to get in trouble or, get dinged for saying the wrong fact. But as time went on and our speeches were being distorted by Fox News anyway, you had to start to wonder, are we missing the forest from the trees here? Are we focusing on these sort of obsessing over these facts when they're going to distort what we say anyway? So it's complicated.
Kind of like what Dan was saying about the timely and the timeless. Yes. You sometimes need to kind of stand back. I guess.
Yeah.
But I think it's something we all face in our work is all these people piling in. And it's even worse now that there's Google Docs. So you can actually see people massacre your speech in real time.
True.
With the cursor moving. And how many people are like editing it at one time? You're like, what am I going to do with this? One thing I found fascinating when I learned this, Sarada, was that you were the only person of color in the president's speech writing team at the time you were there. And then you've since told me you're also the only woman at the time. So what was that like?
Well, I've only ever been a woman of color, so I don't know what it's like to be anything else. I should clarify this. So when the president first got to the White House, Sarah Hurwitz was on his team. She had joined from the campaign. She had been on Hillary's campaign during the primary, went over to Obama's campaign. But as soon as she got there, within a few months, Mrs. Obama very smartly saw that Sarah is a genius and wanted her on her team. So she took Sarah. And Sarah very happily went. Then for years, there was nobody. Then a woman named Megan Rooney, incredibly talented, joined the president's team, maybe 2013 or something like that. But she was only there for about a year. She had written for Secretary Clinton as Secretary of State. And then she went to the Clinton campaign. So we overlapped for a few months, but she wasn't there for very long. And then it was just me until the end. I think that the way that these speechwriting offices are built typically is from the campaign. And the campaign was a bunch of dude bros, for lack of a better term. Just a bunch of 20-something white guys who all decamped to Chicago and worshiped at the altar of Obama. And they all got jobs in the White House. And they're very talented, obviously, and I like them all immensely. But I think there was a bit of an insularity to it. So the second term, I think, skewed older, skewed just sort of more diverse in terms of experiences and life. And so to Cody's credit, one of the reasons he hired me was that I had actually criticized the president's speeches about geared towards women audiences. I just told him that I thought they sucked. And to his credit, when he hired me, he said that's one of the reasons he hired me, that they just needed some other perspective and somebody who had a little bit more experience. And I think over time, we did sort of push him on his rhetoric a little bit and change the sort of overall ethos of it. And that's to Cody's credit too. I mean, he brought a different sensibility to his leadership.
Do you think we as speechwriters, even though we're sort of ghostwriters, we do bring our own perspectives and views and ourselves to our work?
I think it's inevitable,
yeah.
I'm sure you all get this question a lot, but people always ask speechwriters, how do you write for someone you disagree with? and I suspect most of us work really hard to not ever be in that situation. But you know, it's not as though I agreed with every single thing Barack Obama did, or I'm sure you didn't agree with every single thing, you know, David Cameron did. But where we align is on our values, so that if a particular decision he made was not the decision I would have made, I at least trusted his judgment and felt like our values were aligned. However, I do think that what we bring is our inevitably our own life experience, right? So, for example, if I were, we did a sort of a big speech for a big conference, kind of celebrating the things that the administration had done over 8 years on behalf of women and girls equality, what was left to do. This was in 2016. And I mean, the way I wrote it was the way I would write it for myself. And as, you know, a feministy woman. And then he could pull back if he wanted to. But I wrote something that none of the guys probably would have written on their own, because they just didn't have that life experience of living the double standard. So when I put it in there, I really thought the president was gonna cut a lot of it, and he didn't. And I think, again, to his credit, he was somebody who was evolving, and not that he wasn't always a feminist, but I think that having daughters who were then teenagers, just seeing his own staff, just going through life, being president for 8 years, he had gotten to a place where he could see that language and feel like it resonated with him and that it was authentic to him. So sort of a collaboration, I guess.
And then shortly after that, obviously there was an election, and then you left the White House, maybe won't dwell on that too much, but you went freelance and you work for yourself, and you still do. So how was the shift from working for one person, writing in one voice, to many clients, and also writing in your own voice?
Yeah, Dan and I were talking about this yesterday, but I think the sort of the challenge of going from working for someone you really believe in with a mission where you're part of something bigger than yourself, and then you leave that, or it's taken away from you summarily, is really hard. You know, just putting aside the writing, I think even just how you see yourself in the world and your belief in your work and your sense of purpose can really sort of can vanish overnight. And I think that happened to a lot of people after the administration. I think it's why people just, you know, sign up for Doctors Without Borders again and again. You become adrenaline junkies, right? Because you just want to keep doing this thing. So it was, I had the good fortune of having written for multiple people before I went to the White House, because I had been at West Wing Writers. So I generally knew what that was like. But it was a bit of a shift. I always feel like, I'm sure people ask you guys this all the time too, but how do you find someone's voice, right, is the question. And to me, finding someone's voice is not about how they speak, it's about how they think. And so I spent all those years just inhabiting the mind and soul of Barack Obama, which is as creepy as it sounds, and to suddenly sort of think, oh, I now have to do this for other people and for myself, because I also write under my own name. It took a bit. You know, I feel the first few speeches I wrote for other people probably sounded like Barack Obama.
I had that criticism when Theresa May came into Downing Street. I carried on, and I got a speech sent back to me that I'd written for her, and it was this sounds like David Cameron. That was unfair, actually. I didn't last there very long, and I went back to work for Cameron. But yeah, it's hard to make that shift and inhabit other people's voices. We live in a different world now. Populism. They're quite good speakers, though. They're quite engaging. Why are populists so engaging? Why are they good speakers?
I mean, I'm not going to tell you guys anything you don't already know. And we've all been having these discussions over the past few days. I think what we can learn from populists, and there's so many of them now. I think the most talented politician in the world is Narendra Modi from India. Can't stand him, but he's very good at what he does. I think what we can learn is that, to use a word that has now become problematic, maybe, is that they're authentic, right? That authenticity is something that resonates with people. Their unfiltered look at the world is appealing and gives voice to things that people have previously felt but not wanted to say out loud. It's a permission structure. And when everybody takes that permission and gets on board, now you're in a community. And all of that is incredibly appealing. So I think what we can take, and what I'm sure we all sort of push back on in our politics, is the sort of perfunctory talking points and speaking in a kind of political language that doesn't actually resonate with how people live their lives. So that's what I think we're always pushing back on. And in a way, the rise of Trump and the way that he speaks that resonates so profoundly with a certain group of people in America has helped us make that case that we cannot talk like robots anymore, that we cannot speak about economic security. We have to talk about what this actually means in people's lives. So maybe there is a lesson to be learned there that's positive.
And that's not just populist, right? It's nearly 20 years since Obama's famous DNC speech, which obviously helped him to get elected, and that was very authentic, but not populist, and because the message was very inclusive and very powerful about the politics of hope. I'm curious at this point to get questions from other people. I think this is a good moment, either about politics today or Sarah's time.
About whatever you'd like. You can ask about anything.
In the White House?
Yeah, I was interested. I mean, you said it slightly facetiously, the girl speeches. So I wonder what you meant by that. And also, what the boys' speeches were.
That's a great question. All of them. So I want to give, again, Cody and Terry a lot of credit. They never asked me to do something because, sort of with the impression of, well, you're a woman, so you should take this more. Do you want to write about this because you care a lot about it, right? So the same was true for I'm very into music, I'm a musician, and so I would write all the speeches about, you know, where he was where there was a performance at the White House and he had to talk about music. I took those speeches because Cody would give them to me because he knew that I liked them. I don't speak sports, so I didn't do the sports speeches. So there was an element of that. But I do think there was it's complicated because you don't want to be pigeonholed as the person who's going to write this speech for an audience primarily of women, or, you know, dedicating this feminist monument or whatever. At the same time, I felt an obligation to do those speeches because I would do them better. And so I think that we all have that, I don't know, the ways in which our identity intersects with our work are complicated and fraught. And I don't have an answer, but I did feel somewhat of an obligation to take on those speeches where I might have a disproportionate sense of the experience of the audience, for better or worse. You know, I wrote a couple of big immigration speeches because my parents are immigrants, and, you know, but you know what? Terry's are too, and we could do those together. So it's complicated.
It's fascinating, Dan.
What were some of the speeches that you found the hardest to write, either because of the complexity of the speech or the emotion that came with it or the issues? Like, I'm interested in how did that kind of work into the process?
I would say a couple of sort of categories of speeches. One is the kind I was talking about earlier, a speech about anything. So a commencement address, or it's a holiday and he's been, you know, it's Veterans Day or Memorial Day, and this is the seventh time he's giving this speech. And it can be about anything. And that's just a recipe. It's a straight line from anything to nothing. So I found those to be a fun challenge, as long as you weren't inundated with other people's bad ideas. But a challenge for sure. And then the other times that I struggled, and I'm thinking of a particular speech that was really a challenge. It was a commencement address at Howard University in Washington, D.C., which is a historically Black college and university, a particular kind of institution in the United States that has a long history of having served Black students. And the reason that speech was really hard was because I didn't fully have the pen. So the president was kind of in this weird place, and I think Cody was in a weird place, where they couldn't quite relinquish control. So I was sort of the pen, but I didn't have full authority. And for anybody who's ever been in that situation, it's a really tricky thing when you are not the person who is truly making the decision, and you're not sure if the president is looking to you or the other writer. I think it was a reminder to me that process is so important. I mean, I always like to have a conversation about the conversation. You know, how are we going to talk about this, right? Well, I think that's true for speeches too. And I think that there, it was a process problem. So I always try to establish that up front.
Did you feel like he empowered you to say no? Could you, you know, conflict the president or sort of say, don't think you're quite right on this one? Or would it only be on speeches where you were fully holding the pen that you felt like you could challenge him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, typically I feel like he always wanted his staff to disagree. So he would put advisors in a room and let them argue with each other and sort of pressure test arguments in that way. And then he would make a decision. And then it was his decision and it was final. And I think it's a really interesting and important leadership quality, the ability to sort of take in a lot of information, pressure test, and then, but then make a decision and stick with it and say, this is my decision, because someone is accountable for it. On speeches though, it's a little bit different because by the time it got to him, we had done all the work to make it sound as much like him as possible, but now it's gonna be, he's the one who's getting up there to deliver it. And no one at the end of that speech is gonna say, gosh, Sarita gave a shitty speech. They're gonna say Barack Obama did. And so he owns those words and it would be really important, I think, for him to feel good about it. So yes, we could say, you know, I think this might not go over well. you could, but I cannot think of a single time when he made an edit that I was not happy with or that I thought would not go over well. That might be different for Cody and Ben, who wrote these huge speeches of much greater significance than the ones I did. But in general, I never felt like that. I might feel like an edit Cody or one of my teammates made, I might push back on, but I can't think of one where.
I guess that's the kind of the challenge, but also the upside of working for a great orator is that, you know, they'll be quite hard on you, but also their edits will be the best.
Yeah.
Can't really,
it's really
disagree.
Really...
Helen.
Could you talk a bit about what you've done since leaving the White House? I'm interested if, did you have a piece of work or something you did where you thought I could not be further away and more different or more unusual from what I did in the White House? Like, is there something you've done since that you think, wow, this is the biggest distance I could imagine being from there? Or are you just, do you feel you're continuing with similar kind of types of work just in a different sense?
Yeah, it's pretty similar. Okay. So I'm still doing speeches, but sort of broader, I'll do broader communications work than speeches. So helping sort of an organization tell its story more broadly, not necessarily by one leader. One of the projects I'm doing now, or that I have been doing for a few years, that is unlike any writing I've done before, is I'm the lead scriptwriter for the presidential museum that is being built for President Obama. So in America, again, we're so weird. When I say these things out loud to non-American audiences, it's just, we are so weird. So for some reason, we allow our presidents to build presidential museums to themselves. It's like, you know, our own Sistine Chapel. It's really weird. So President Obama is building his, and I'm the scriptwriter, which means it's a museum. So I'm writing the labels that will describe the exhibit. And we're speechwriters. This is not the kind of writing we do. And I remember that, you know, there are all these really specific parameters. So can you imagine me and Barack Obama sitting there and tell the story of the war in Afghanistan in 75 words in a high school reading level that could be understood by non-English speakers. Go. and he said, it was supposed to be an eighth grade reading level. And he said, Sarita, don't tell them, but we're not gonna do an eighth grade reading level. Like, we just can't, it's impossible, you know. So that's been really interesting, a different kind of writing. Of course, it's the most closely related to him personally that I'm doing, because I'm not, you know, my other clients are not Barack Obama, but it is unlike anything I've ever done and has been very interesting. And then of course I get to write under my own name so I can criticize whoever I want in a way that I couldn't when I worked directly in government.
Must be refreshing.
I'm really interested to know, because you say that President Obama was kind of involved in the process towards the end, and you give his edits and sometimes his sphere. Would he ever kind of go off the cuff when he was doing speeches? Just kind of go on like that? Like, how often did that happen? How far away from the script would he stray?
Yeah. I think more than most speakers, is very disciplined. And this probably came from having been in public life for so long, being incredibly busy, appreciating the fact that we were there. He was a better speechwriter than all of us, obviously, but he also didn't have time to be writing his speeches. So I think he gave us a level of deference that was important for the process to work. Mm-hmm. If, you know, if he was spending his time editing the remarks he was going to be giving to the, you know, Hispanic American Heritage reception, then that's, you know, 20 less, fewer minutes that he can spend in the Situation Room dealing with some crisis in China. And that's the way you have to think. We would always say, as which is true for any major leader, their most precious asset is their time. So I say all of that because I don't want people to think that he was sort of contrived or practiced in the way, and inauthentic in the way he spoke. It's just that he would take the time to read the speech ahead of time, make sure it was what he wanted, but then deliver it and not blow it up. Also because I think he respected his audience. However, he 100% would go off the cuff sometimes, usually to make jokes. Or because he saw someone in the audience or he remembered a story. And so often it was those off the cuff moments that made the news. So we would labor away on a speech that we thought was so thoughtful. And then the one thing that he says, as you all know, your boss says that one thing and that's the thing that makes the news. And so that this would happen frequently. But there was one time that really stuck with me. This is 2015, and we, again, America being so distorted. I love my country, but oh my gosh, we're so weird. And in this case, horrible, which is our gun culture, as you all know, is deeply problematic, hard to change. And in 2015, the president announced a bunch of executive actions around guns. So these are things that he could do without Congress. And I wrote the speech for this and or worked with him on it. And we have this section where he's listing off a bunch of the major mass shootings that we had had. And he got to Newtown, which was the a shooting at an elementary school where 19 first graders died. And he got to that part and he stopped and he started tearing up, which for Barack Obama is unusual. And he just ad-libbed and he just said, "Every time I think about those kids, it makes me mad." And I was in the room, I could hear the cameras, just like the press is just clicking, 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 watching as he's just wiping away. But that line of what, which he just said, which just came from him, was the one that made the news.
Couldn't have really come up with that in prep. That's a kind of in the moment.
Totally.
Yeah.
And actually at the time, I didn't have children, not that you have to have children to feel that, but I wonder now if, I have a first grader, if I would write that speech differently.
Just on sort of similar kind of moment, the moment when he went to a memorial for a civil rights leader who died at the funeral and breaks into song.
Oh, yeah. Which I will forever imagine a verbal phrase. Yeah, so do you guys know that story? Cody tells this story in his book, Grace, which if you haven't read is worth reading. It's really lovely. But, you know, Cody, because I'm a music person, he had said, "Can you just compile a list of all the potential spirituals and hymns that we could maybe use the lyrics of?" And so we had done that, and then they had chosen Amazing Grace, and the president said on the plane to Cody, I was not there, I was not involved in the speech, and he said to Cody, "There's a 50-50 chance that I sing." And I think in the room he felt it. You know, there's an energy, right? You can feel whether it's the appropriate thing to do, and that tradition of singing is, and sort of from the heart, being able to decide to do that is a deep sort of value in the Black church. And he was aware of that because that's the tradition he came from. So yeah, he just did it.
But it was in the plan that it,
I don't think Cody thought that it was gonna happen. I don't think Cody wrote that in thinking Barack Obama is gonna sing. You don't think Barack Obama, singer. But but I think he himself, because he's the one who put those lines in. So, you know, President Obama shows Amazing Grace. He wrote that section of the speech. I think he's the one who realized he could pull that off. But Cody wouldn't have known that he could pull that off, right? Even after having worked for him for a decade.
You're a musician. Do you bring your musicality to your speech writing? Do you think that's why you're kind of good at it and enjoy it and enjoy the rhythms and the phrasing of speeches?
Yeah, Terry and I were just talking about this. I do think, I mean, you know, you don't have to be a musician to love music. I'm sure lots of people here do. And I do think there is something about sort of being trained to hear things, to sort of think about what you're hearing and the cadence of it and the rhythm and the importance of silence. All of those things, I think, are learned as a musician and probably relevant. And when I made the switch, because I became a speechwriter sort of later than most people, right? I was 30 when I wrote my first speech. Probably it, I gravitated towards it, I think, in part because of that.
Interesting. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, sorry.
You talked a bit about how you hoped that you, well, you may sort of change the president's attitude on rhetoric or sort of shape some of his rhetoric. I was wondering, now that you are not working with him quite as closely in some regards, what are the kinds of things that you think he may have changed in your rhetoric to write something?
Oh, that's a really good question. The question was, you know, how did maybe he change my rhetoric or my way of writing? I think what President Obama is really good at doing is, and maybe this is the lawyer in him, he's very good at structure. And I think spending time writing for him just helped me get better at structure and think really logically and approach it from that perspective, which I think already was where I was going. I'm not the kind of person who thinks, let me just sit in a coffee shop and wait for inspiration. I mean, that's just not, we all work on deadlines. You need a process. And for me, structure is really helpful. I also think I really admire clean writing, very clean writing. One of my favorite writers is E.B. White, who I think just is sort of the model of clean writing. And I think President Obama has that too. So he would see in a speech something that looked like a line, like a, something that you were sort of supposed to perform and deliver and maybe get applause. And he would say, this is a line, and he would cross it out. I've taken that now so that when people want sound bites, when clients want me to write a sound bite, I will tell them this and say, you know, Barack Obama is right, that the line that you think is gonna get applause probably won't. So make an argument, right? Connect with people, don't just say a line because it's clever.
It's fascinating. The amount of times I get asked to write sound bites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like,
not that easy, Louise.
I just had a quick question. If you could write for anyone, the dream person to stand up and hear a speech you've written, who would that be?
Oh my goodness. Living or not living, anyone?
It would be trickier than not.
It would be tricky. Oh my goodness. There's many people. I think they'd probably all be women. There was a really important a woman who was in the forefront of both women's voting rights and sort of civil rights. A woman named Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, and she was somebody who delivered some of the most amazing speeches that people haven't heard, and I wish I'd written for her.
Having worked there, it's a really good opportunity to ask, when you're at a level of, you know, the level you've been working at, David Cameron, Barack Obama, and your principal is doing an overseas visit, you know, maybe making a speech at Downing Street or in Parliament, for example, how much collaboration is there between the office of each principal? And how does that work politically? Is it sometimes more difficult to maneuver?
Between the different leaders' offices?
Yeah. So if Obama was it down the street or Cameron was at the White House, would the offices work together to collaborate on?
I think they often do, and there's often joint op-eds where offices work together and one will tend to take the lead.
Yeah.
In the special relationship, I think.
Especially our countries.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have much experience of
only that? A little, because I wasn't a foreign policy speechwriter, but the times that I did have to write, I did a trip to Vietnam and Japan. And so for that, for example, Terry, who was running these foreign policy speeches, had me speak to our embassy there. And then their embassy put me in touch with their local contacts who worked in the government so that we were getting, you know, the local color and what kinds of cultural references we should make. And saying hello in their native language, what the president always did. There's actually a great video on YouTube of the president saying hello in a bunch of different languages. They've just strung together all of the times he did that. So there was some amount of collaboration. Of course, it depended on the country. So very close allies like the United Kingdom and the United States or Canada, different from going to a country where that may not be the case.
I think we've got time for maybe one or two.
One more.
Guys stood up, so that means something. Yeah.
I was just wondering, we all know these famous speeches like Perfect Union, or in your mind or in your opinion, what was Obama's most impressive speech? Not in terms of like wooing the audience, but where you think on a speech writing craft level.
I always thought the speech he gave at Hiroshima was really...
Sorry?
He gave a speech at Hiroshima.
Oh, yeah.
And I really liked that speech. I had nothing to do with it. Ben Rhodes worked on it. But I just think it's a really well done piece of work and meaningful. But I used to love writing the speeches that we would call Rose Garden rubbish. So the president of the United States is unusually in the world, both head of government and head of state. So he has to give speeches of great import on policy and international relations. And he also has to congratulate the team that won the World Cup at the White House. And right, he sort of has this ceremonial role too. And some of those speeches, I think we worked really hard to make them, to tie them to the broader American project. They could have been sort of empty speeches that were a little bit maybe trite, maybe just silly even, and we would always try to make them say something deeper about the meaning of America. And so I really loved those speeches, whether they were about, you know, a performance at the White House or you know, something along those lines. I found great meaning in those speeches, even though most people never saw them.
I guess every speech he gives is important.
Yeah.
He's the president of the United States.
Exactly.
And often those Rose Garden rubbish ones are the ones that will just take off for some reason or other. So you never quite know. Every speech you write is important.
Yeah, exactly.
Guys, just give me permission for one more teeny tiny question, if anyone's got one.
I can also... Oh, go ahead. I was going to tell you guys this quick story.
Okay.
Let's end with that.
Can I do that?
Yeah.
Because I think this is, speechwriters will appreciate this. I was going to tell one, but that's more serious. Let me just tell you guys this one. Okay. So the first time I had to travel with the president, it was just an event in town. He was speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus, which was exactly what it sounds like. All the black members of Congress have a caucus, and they have this huge weekend in DC, a gala and fundraising for scholarships. It's a big deal. Every president speaks at it, obviously a big deal when the first black president is speaking at it. But this is, you know, year six of him doing this. Mrs. Obama was going to the speech too. This was it was a Saturday, it was in the fall. It was a beautiful, you know, fall day. And I had written the speech that Thursday or something, sent it to him for edits, but I hadn't gotten any edits back. And Cody said, well, go to the office. It was Saturday now. The speech was Saturday night. Go to the office, wait for edits there. Maybe they'll come in, except it was a beautiful fall day and the president spent all day playing golf. And so I wasn't getting any edits. So I'm sitting in my office waiting. And finally the evening rolls around, there are no edits. And Cody says, okay, well, there's probably no edits. So just get going. And we had to go in the motorcade to the convention center where the speech was happening. This is my first time in the motorcade. I'd never gone. And so I didn't really know what you're supposed to do. So for some reason, I took my BlackBerry at the time. I took my personal cell phone. I took a hard copy of the speech. I don't know why. And then I took my wallet. Why did I take my wallet? Did I think I needed money to shop? Like, what was, I don't know why I did this. So I'm carrying all these things and I go over to where you enter the motorcade is in the residential part of the White House, the beautiful rooms. And you go through the old treaty room, the blue room. It's called the diplomatic reception room, walk through, and then everybody, all the staff gets into the vans, and then everybody is seated, and then the president eventually gets in and you just go. So you have to be ready and you leave. So I get in the staff van and introduce myself or, you know, say hi to people, waiting, and then finally the door opens And this guy, who I now know as Joe, but at the time I didn't know him, he said, I was new. He said, are you the speechwriter? I said, yes. And he said, great, here are the president's edits. He drops a folder on my lap. The door closes. Not 3 seconds later, we leave because the president's already in the car. And I was like, wait, what? I just got the edits. So it takes 4 minutes to get to the convention center because when you're in the motorcade, they've cleared all the streets of Washington, right? And I'm panicking because I've never done this. I've worked in teleprompters before, but not for the president. I just have no idea how I'm going to make these edits. So we pull up in the convention center, and for anybody who's worked with world leaders, you know that you never go through the front door with a world leader. You're always going through the back, like past the trash bins and back exit entrance. So we go in, and it's a long line of a motorcade because Mrs. Obama is with us too, so there's extra security. So I'm walking up this long driveway trying to get to the the back entrance of the convention center. But the president is right there. His limo is right in front. And he gets out of the car, and Mrs. Obama gets out. She's all beautiful and glamorous in her dress. And he comes around and helps her to the thing. And I'm like, come on, people, move. And they get to the entrance. And of course, there's a whole line of people who are there to say hi to them. And I can't get in the building. And clearly, I have panic in my eyes. Because our trip director, there's always somebody who's sort of responsible for coordinating the trip. It's this big guy, Luke. And he sees me, and he sees my panic. He reads me very well, and he says, okay, I got you. And he kind of pulls me. I'm, as you can see, very small. He's this big dude. And he kind of drags me past the president and their, line of adoring fans. And he takes me to the back, and he takes me right to the teleprompter. And it's a huge backstage area. And it turns out that the president was going to be doing, and the first lady were going to be doing a rope line before the event. That means they're taking pictures with people who get to see them. And so I had a little bit of extra time. And so I go straight to the teleprompter. And I said that the teleprompter is controlled by, it's sort of military communications because it has to be secure. So the people who run the teleprompters are these very young military guys and girls. And so this young guy is sitting there. He couldn't have been more than, 23. And I said, do you operate the teleprompter? And he said, oh, yes, ma'am, I do. He's just like, young guy. and I was like, I have edits, and honey, I need you to move. So I just sort of move him over. I sit down, and I start making these edits. And fortunately, the president is still doing the rope line, taking pictures, whatever. So I'm making these edits. And then I'm done, proofread it. And then I told you guys that sometimes prompters break, so you have to have a hard copy, as we all know. So we have to print out the hard copy. And then this is the glamour of being a speechwriter. Then you're taking out the pages in the old binder, the old speech and these plastic protectors, and I'm putting in the new one, and I'm on the floor doing all these things.
You need to wrap it up, sorry.
So then I'm done. Great, the president is waiting to go out. I'm standing there, I'm holding the binder, which I now hand over. I'm holding the folder of edits, the folder that I brought with the speech, my BlackBerry, my phone, and for some reason, my wallet. And I'm standing there, the president's over there, and he's just chatting with staff, and I just drop everything. I don't know why. Drop everything. Pages go all over the place. So I'm, and again, they've taken the actual book, it's just a disaster. So I'm on the floor, and I'm picking up these pages, and the president just kind of saunters over to me. Like, I've met him at this point maybe twice. And he looks down, he looks at the pages, looks back at me, and he says, is that my speech? I said, yes, sir, I'm still on the ground picking up pages. It's your speech. And he says, so what? I'm just going to get up there, open it up, and say, in conclusion.
Amazing.
Thank you so much.